Well, good morning. Welcome to Open Session 207, the Clinical and Ethical Dangers of Multiple Relationships at Group Analytic Institutes. I'm Dr. Pepper, and like my counterpart here, I'm so misunderstood. It's a pleasure to be here, actually, in the state of Texas. It's the home of the original Dr. Pepper. So, there you go. There you go. So, a couple of disclaimers. First of all, as you may know, this is being recorded, and so nothing is confidential. I would like people to ask questions, to have responses. When you do, I would ask you to come forward to the open, this mic in front here. That's how it gets recorded, on the mic. If you talk from your seat, it may not get picked up. The other thing is that the topic of ethics and boundaries may raise your anxiety, because it always raises mine when I talk about it. Talking about boundaries is an essential part of the process of doing group, but it's fraught with conflict. Now, before I begin, many years ago, my father had given me the advice that if I ever give a public speech, I should start with a joke. So, in the memory of my father, I thought, let me tell something that I think is both appropriate and maybe even amusing. It's a story about this fellow who has a 7 a.m. appointment with his shrink, and he comes into the office. His clothes are a mess. He's got a wild look in his eye. His hair's all disheveled. He sits down face to face, and he says to the shrink, he says, "Doc, I just had this terrible nightmare before I woke up. I had this dream that we're sitting in session face to face as we are now, and as I'm talking to you, your face turned into my mother's face." He said, "I got so upset, I jumped out of bed, I threw on whatever clothes I could find, I drank a glass of orange juice for breakfast and ran over here as quickly as I could." The therapist leans forward and says to him, "A glass of juice? That's your idea of a breakfast?" It's all about boundaries. I've been asked to read the objectives of the presentation, so let me do that without any further ado. Learning objectives. List the 8 dangers of blurred boundaries to patient trainees in analytic group institutes. 2, differentiate boundary crossings from boundary violations at these organizations. And 3, identify the iatrogenic treatment reactions of blurred boundaries in training organizations in which multiple relationships exist. Before I begin, I'd like to say something. That's supposed to be funny. One of the reasons that I'm misunderstood is that I've been accused of looking down at analytic institutes from my ivory tower as a professional sociologist. I'm also a therapist, and that I have no feel for the real day-to-day struggles of analytic institutes in terms of survival. Now, the reason why we're talking about analytic institutes as opposed to other kinds of institutes is because of the nature of analysis, which deals with transference and countertransference and resistance. If you're not dealing with countertransference and transference, then this doesn't apply. But when you're talking about transference and countertransference, you're talking about unconscious process. And that's why it's so important to consider boundaries. So, the fact is that my interest in this topic is more than just academic. It comes from my own experience many years ago as a trainee in an analytic institute where I saw all kinds of untoward things going on and didn't know what to make of it. I knew I was affected by it. It created a lot of anxiety and discord in my life. And it took me many years to figure out what was going on. And when I figured out what was going on, I wrote this book. This book is called Emotional Incest in Group Psychotherapy, A Conspiracy of Silence. It's quite a title, right? But it's based on my experiences in a training institute and having made sense of them after I got out. And so even the book is not just an analytic, turgid treatise. It's actually my story, my journey as becoming a therapist. The good news and the bad news is I learned my craft, and I love what I do. I run 6 groups a week in my practice in Queens, but I learned as much about what not to do as what to do from the people who trained me and the people who were my therapist. So having said that, now obviously in the interest of time, I'm not going to have time to go through all of these 8 dangers in detail, but I would like to focus on the ones that specifically apply to group therapists in training. And so I've listed them here. I will go through them kind of quickly. And if you have any questions, like I said, please feel free to ask. Okay. So the first one is breaches of confidentiality. Yes. Yeah, sure. No problem. I could forward this to you. It's actually on my website. And the address of the website is on the handout. You can find it on the website. Just take a step back. I need to explain how I got to where I figured all this out by telling you that, as I said, I am trained as a sociologist. And as a sociologist, I learned to look at social systems from a different perspective than most of my colleagues who were trained in psychology, who looked at individual motivation. And one of my one of the men who I'm most impressed with in terms of his writing about the sociology of organizations is a man named Philip Slater, who's no longer alive. He was a brilliant social psychologist who, if you're old enough, may remember, he wrote Pursuit of Loneliness, Wealth Addiction, Earth Walk, A Dream Deferred, so on and so forth. Well, we all know that when we study individual motivation, we know that the world is based on duality, or the world of individual motivation is based on duality. We love and we hate the people we're closest to. We want to change, and yet we resist it. We seek stability in our lives, and we also seek excitement and adventure. All emotion is based on duality. As it turns out, in fact, one of the chapters in my new book, I've written 2, if I may, this one's called Some People Don't Want What They Say They Want. And it's based on my experience with people who are ambivalent. The nature of all human emotion is ambivalence. One chapter is called Go Away, But Don't Leave Me Alone. You get it, everybody gets it. It's irrationally, it makes perfect sense, right? People want closeness and they'll do what they have to do to push it away. In any case, Slater talked about organizations having dual or contradictory needs, and I just want to read what he said about organizations. He said, every system needs change and stability, deviation and conformity, creation and destruction, cooperation and competition, individualism and collectivism. Contradictory needs. Organizations try to balance those needs by trying to promote one need over the other, but they go together, and invariably the need that's being repressed comes out. Well, in training organizations, in addition to those needs, organizations have conflicting needs. Analytic organizations, training institutes have conflicting needs. The need to teach and the need to treat. They are mutually exclusive. Treating and teaching under the same roof produces iatrogenic reaction, can produce iatrogenic reactions. Iatrogenic means a negative treatment reaction that's related to the treatment itself. So if you go to an allergy doctor, let's say, and he gives you a shot, and as a result of the shot, your arm blows up, that's an iatrogenic reaction. The conflict between teaching and treating exists when dual relationships exist within organizations. By dual relationships, I mean
The group therapists are also the supervisors, the teachers, the administrators, the friends, the colleagues, and even relatives of their students. The students, in turn, who are group members with each other, are also fellow supervisees, fellow students, fellow colleagues, and even relatives. When the boundaries are blurred in that way, my basic point is altering the frame of analytic treatment always has consequences. When you change the frame, you always affect something. It's really chaos theory. You know from, James Clerk wrote about chaos theory, butterfly effect. One small change in one part of the system will reverberate through the system. You know, if a butterfly flaps its wings in China, 3 days later it rains in California, something like that. The point is, the initial idea about training was Freud, right? Now, fascinating thing about Freud was that Freud disdained academia. And so, in response to that, he created the first freestanding institute where training and treatment took place under the same roof with the expected consequences. Although, he didn't expect. What I'm saying is the consequences now, in retrospect, were clear. He had very complicated relationships with his trainees. You know the story, perhaps, about his relationship to Helena Deutsch and to Ferenczi. The first case, I think I'm going too fast. Am I speeding? Am I speaking too fast? The first case of an iatrogenic treatment reaction was that of Victor Tausk. Victor Tausk was a student of Freud. He admired Freud. He wanted Freud to analyze him. But Freud was threatened by this guy. He saw him as a competitor and wouldn't analyze him. He referred him to Helene Deutsch. Apparently, and Helene Deutsch was Freud's protege. Apparently, Deutsch spent his sessions with... Tausk spent his sessions with Deutsch complaining about Freud. And Helena Deutsch complained in her sessions about Tausk, to the point where Freud said, well, you got to get rid of Tausk or you can't work with me. So sure, she dumped Tausk, and he proceeded to commit suicide. Now, Tausk was no angel himself. At the time of his death, he was engaged to one of his patients, which is one of the dangers, by the way. I call it dumping, or the pass-along effect. When people are trained in an environment where the boundaries are blurred, they tend not to learn about the importance of boundaries and pass it on to their own patients. So, for example, a colleague of mine who was trained in one of these institutes where people had all kinds of complicated relationships with each other called me one day to complain that one of the women in her group, who was a lawyer, some kind of professional, lost her job. So my colleague thought she was being helpful, so she decided to hire this patient to walk her dog. She lived in a suburban house, and on the first day of the job, my colleague said she saw this patient dog walker now attempt to give the dog a treat, chocolate. Anybody knows anything about dogs knows that chocolate is poison. Well, my colleague was furious with this woman. And she's telling me this story, and I'm thinking, you set the whole thing up. This was not the patient's transference. Maybe it was. It occurred to me that perhaps the patient was acting out her murderous rage toward the therapist, who was, in a way, humiliating her and saying, this is the best you can do. You can walk my dog. But she didn't get it. She didn't see that she was part of the problem. My colleague didn't see that she was part of it. Do you understand what I'm saying? To interpret all negative treatment reactions as transference is crazy-making, which is another one of the dangers. Gaslighting. Gaslighting comes from the famous movie of the 40s, Gaslight. You know that with Ingmar Bergman and Charles Boyer and Joseph Cotten? It's a wonderful movie. It's a story about how it's supposed to take place in the end of the 1800s, maybe beginning 1900s, where gaslight was the way houses were lit. The story is this man, Charles Boyer, the husband, tries to drive his wife crazy by invalidating her perceptions of reality. At night he goes out, and when he goes out, the house, the lights dim, the gas lights go down, because he's doing some nefarious thing we find out later in the movie. When he comes back, his wife says, "I don't understand what happened. As soon as you left, the lights went down." He said, "No, they didn't." He had separated her from other, in addition, separated her from other sources of external validation, so she began to question her own perception. When someone tells you that what you're perceiving is transference, what they're saying is it's a distortion. The Hollywood ending was that Joseph Cotten is this handsome stranger who's watching this whole thing play out from a distance, and he comes in at the nick of time and saves her from going crazy. It's a Hollywood ending. To give an example of, I'm jumping around, but that's okay, right? To give an example of gaslighting from my own experience, I was in a training group with a world-famous group leader, and the world-famous group leader had very complicated relationships with the students, patients, in this group. I was just in the training group. I had been, personally, I had a little backstory. I first started my own therapy in my early 20s. I started because I was having difficulty with a romantic relationship that went bad. And even at that tender age, I realized I must have had something to do with it. So I didn't know anything about anything at 22. I asked a friend of mine who was in treatment if he could ask his therapist to recommend somebody who had a practice near where I lived. That was the only criteria. I didn't want to go too far. So he refers me to this guy. The first day, I approach this guy. I come to the office. He opens the door. He's wearing no shoes. There's stocking feet. He ushers me into the treatment room. There's incense burned. This is the 70s, so it's like, you know, anything goes. He sat in the lotus position. He had a shaved head and a Fu Manchu. I thought this guy was God, you know. After a year or so of individual, he recommended group. I went into an all-men's group and stayed there for 8 years. It was a very intense relationship, but it all changed. After maybe a year or two of that, he said to me, "You know, I think you'd make a good therapist. Why don't you join my clinic?" I trusted him. I went into the clinic. I became a student, and I began to see things about him that I never would have seen as a patient. What I saw was he was a philanderer. He had sexual relationships with many of his female supervisees. Where was I supposed to talk about this? That's a little bit of why I'm doing what I'm doing. It was driving me crazy. So anyway, I vowed after that I needed training, but I would never be in treatment and training with the same person ever again. And that never happened. Anyway, so I'm in this training group, and one of the women in the group who's in treatment and in training with this world-renowned therapist, group therapist, begins to complain about the fact that she's not being treated well in the institute because other people, her group siblings, were closer to the leader and they had access to the perks of the system, like teaching positions, like referrals of patients, like representing the organization in conferences across the world. She was complaining that she wasn't getting what she thought was her due. Several of the patients, the members of that group, the training group, were also in group therapy with her and knew her history. Apparently, she was in a family where she was the only girl, the youngest girl, and the rest of her siblings were brothers, and her father preferred the brothers to her. So these people who knew her from the therapy group said to her, "You're jealous because of your transference. Because your father favored your brothers, that's why you're doing it here." I could see this woman beginning to decompensate right in front of my eyes. And at the end of the group, I didn't say anything during the group because I was always identified as an outlier and I didn't want to put myself in that position. But I went up to her afterwards and I said to her, "This is not all your problem." She didn't listen to me. She was too invested in the system to realize what I was saying. What I was saying to her indirectly was, "You got set up. This is not just your transference. Always an element of transference in everything. But there was another reality, because the fact was the men in that organization and even some of the women, other people got treated differently than she did. But there was so much gratification going on. Referral of patients. People were making a very good living off of this this therapist who referred people to them, set them up in supervisor relations, so on and so forth. So she was being gaslit. Let me go back to the first one. How's it going so far? Is this interesting to anybody beside me? What am I doing with my glasses? Let me see my glasses. Oh, right there. Look at them. So, confidentiality or breaches thereof. I handed you an excerpt from a paper I wrote called "Is Group Psychotherapy Inherently Unethical?" It's really a rhetorical question. And by the way, my website address is there. Anybody who wants to look at the blogs, look at this. This is on the website under the blogs. Everything I've written pretty much is on the... So what happened was, after I wrote my first book, Emotional Incest and Group Psychotherapy, I got a call from a colleague who asked me if I was familiar with an article called Confidentiality in Group Therapy, Empirical Findings and the Law. It's an obscure little article that appeared in the International Journal some years ago. I recommend everyone read it because it blew my mind. What the article said essentially is that in most states, in the United States, confidentiality is not guaranteed by law. The court argues that if more than two people know it, then why not the world? So that blew my mind. Because then I began to think, well, if confidentiality is not guaranteed by law, then how can I practice? Well, the fact is I didn't give up my practice. And if you're interested in finding out, we can talk about that, how I managed to accommodate that. But the point is that in relationships where people know each other in different contexts, there can be no confidentiality. Dual relationships, by definition, breach confidentiality. And here, you know, one of the things that goes on here, and I think it's very important, obviously, is the institutes and the workshops. At the beginning of workshops and institutes that I've attended, the leader says, and we all agree that whatever goes on here stays in the room. And everyone nods their head, and everyone knows that's not true. In fact, if anyone brought up the topic of confidentiality or lack of thereof, it would take up the whole institute. Because the real question is, it's not safe to say anything. Even if you maintain confidentiality, a chain is as strong as its weakest link. If even one person in that group, and you see it all the time, people are so casual about it. You know, I was walking, it was last year or so, a colleague, after the next day after the party, and we're talking, and then some person comes past us, and he acknowledges this person, and he says to me, "I was in an institute with so-and-so. That's who I said hello to. He's nuts." I mean, right, you know, thought nothing about saying it. I said, you know, what are you talking about? You know, and it's not a matter of intelligence. It's really not a matter of intelligence. There's a blind spot when you're too close to it. One of our most esteemed colleagues, if I have it someplace here, was interviewed. I don't have it. He was interviewed about his work with groups, and he's telling the story of his journey of group. He started like I did. It's a funny thing. He began therapy, personal reasons. His therapist said to him, "Why don't you join one of my groups?" And he did. And he presents this in a very casual way, without any word of how complicated his treatment became once he made that decision. Once he morphed from just patient to trainee, everything had to change. It had to change. Because one of the dangers of breaches of confidentiality leads to looping. Looping comes from the work of Irvin Goffman, famous sociologist, wrote a book called The Silence, among other things. And he studied group therapy sessions in mental hospitals. And he noted a fascinating but disturbing phenomenon. That is, in the therapy groups, and it's kind of like the therapy group that I talked about before, people would reveal confidential information that got looped back to them in other settings in a negative way, like this woman who told them, who complained about the perks of the system, and then it was fed back to her, well, this is your transference because your father didn't, you know. That's looping. How am I doing here? How are we doing? The thing I want to concentrate on here is what affects students, trainees, in a very pernicious way, and that is, did I have the eight? Did I? After I wrote the book, I realized that there was eight, not seven. Do I have? I don't think I have it. I think. The double bind. There it is. The double bind. The double bind. The double bind is a pernicious trap that trainees who are in dual relationships fall into. As a patient, the directive is to say everything. As a student, to say everything is potentially politically suicidal. If you want the perks of the system, you have to play the game. So my ironic conclusion is that the treatment of group therapists is the most compromised treatment of all. What? And so I was in this training group with Ormond. He's a brilliant man, and in fact, I learned so much about working with difficult patients with Ormond, but he really had no concept of boundaries. At the time that he was forming his institute, he asked me if I would serve as the ethical director or whatever. So I went to a board meeting, and I brought up the issue of blurred boundaries. And in front of a whole group of people, he said, well, that's the way I was trained, so that's the way it's going to be here too. And then he asked me, would I be the ethical director? And I said, no. I said to him, unless you're 150% behind me, I'll just make a fool of myself. Who's going to listen? Robert Pepper says, what you're doing is... I'll be the laughingstock. I didn't take the job, and I never looked back. I didn't regret it, because I knew about the double bind. The double bind was actually initially formulated by Gregory Bateson and Jay Haley in the study of schizophrenic families. They were interviewing schizophrenic patients in the context of the family, and he taught one. There was one incident where one of them was observing a schizophrenic guy on a back ward when his mother, the patient's mother, came to visit him one day. So the patient goes to embrace his mother as he sees her, and she tenses up, and he backs off, and she accuses him of being unloving. That's the double bind. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. He went to approach her. She backed off. He backed off. He's not a loving son. The double bind in training is that to say what you're observing about all that's going on can lead to the lack of referrals. One of the chapters in my book, the first book, is called Other People's Stories. One of the most horrendous stories that wasn't mine was... A woman told me that she had been in a training institute, an ALEC institute, and it was all women. It was an all-women's institute, and she was in an all-women's therapy group. Well, after a couple of years of being in an all-women's group, she thought she was ready to be in a group with men too. So she told her therapist and the group that she was going to be leaving that group. She wanted to stay in the institute, but she wanted to be in a group with men. And she thought it was okay. They processed it until one day she got a call from the director of the training institute, who called her into the office and said, I heard you're leaving us for a man. And she went nuts. How do you know this? She said to the director, how do you know this? The director said, I make it my business to know everything. Can you imagine? This poor woman was in her, she's never... I feel so bad for her. She's never gone back into training. She's a group therapist, but she would never go back into training based on what happened to her. I mean, it's horrendous. And, you know, there was a running, or there is a, if you guys are on Facebook, there's a group called the Therapist Groupie. It's a forum for therapists to talk about issues. It's a worthwhile thing. You should check it out. And there was a running dispute, not a dispute, well, a dialogue back and forth about, I forgot how we got into it, about these dual relationship things. And so, where am I going with this? Some people were saying to me, dual relationships are wonderful. I have no problems with them. It's been very helpful. And, you know, there are some people who do very well with dual relationships. But there are vulnerable people who don't. And my thought is that even if one person is negatively affected by their participation in dual relationships, then it has to be examined. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that because Robert Pepper says, you know, this is harmful, that organizations are going to change. No. But what I am saying is it's up to you, students and trainees in your organizations, to be alert to your own personal negative reactions and to consider that perhaps it's not just your problem. iatrogenic reactions. What was I? Something else I wanted to say. Does somebody have anybody have a question right now?
Can you talk about the Emperor's New Clothes effect?
The Emperor's New Clothes effect. The Emperor's New Clothes effect literally happened to me. As I said, when I was training with this therapist, my first therapist, he put me in a group, and a number of the people in the group were also in the institute where I was training. I didn't know that before. I just saw them. And it was such a culture shock to see people in the two different frameworks. Well, you know, we all regress in group, and then you see other people in the outside life. But what got me was how obsequious some of these people were in relationship to this guy that I didn't see when I was a patient. In any case, as I said at the beginning, I picked him as a therapist because he worked near where I live. Well, eventually he moved. I live in Queens. He moved his office from Queens into Manhattan. And when he moved into Manhattan, he made his apartment is also his office. That wasn't the way it was in Queens. In Queens, he had a professional building, lived someplace else. Anyway, so one day I walk into the office apartment a little bit early. The front door is locked. I walk in. To the left is a little waiting area. To the right is his living quarters, and on the other side is the treatment room. And they're separated by this little foyer that serves as a waiting room, and there's a common bathroom in this area. So I'm sitting there, a few seconds go by. He comes out in his tighty-whities. He's wearing nothing but his underwear. And he looks at me, he says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "What are you doing here?" And he slammed it all in back, and I was shaking, you know. So when the group began, I said to myself, I have to say something. I can't let this go. So I said how I felt intruded upon. The group rallied around him and said, I intruded on him. And he didn't protect me. He didn't own up to the fact that he had really blurred a boundary. And I was dealt with a situation where I was saying that the emperor is not wearing clothes. Literally. And no one heard it. No one heard it. And believe it or not, that wasn't the last straw. I stayed with him for some time afterwards because I was enmeshed. But I got out of treatment with him, and I went into treatment with someone who had no background in group, individual, wonderful woman I stayed with for 30 years until she retired. And she kept saying to me, you got to get out of there. And I said, well, you don't understand, you know. It's kind of like telling someone who's being in an abusive relationship they got to get out. They can't get out until they're ready to get out. And I wasn't ready to get until I was ready to get out. And when I got out, then I began to see what I'd been exposed to. In fact, it's so fascinating how this stuff works. As an undergraduate, one of my sociology professors, a woman named Joan Dulchin, wrote her doctoral dissertation about the lack of confidentiality in training institutes. I was 20 years old. I didn't know an institute from a Schmidt Institute. I didn't know what she was talking about. And then when I got out of that environment, I said, wait a second, I know somebody who's written about that. And I read her dissertation, and she referred in the dissertation to an article or a couple of articles by a husband and wife team in Oklahoma, the Temelins, Jane and Maurice Temelin, who wrote about psychotherapy cults. And bingo, I started reading these articles, and it was exactly what I went through. And I read her dissertation. Fascinating. I'll give you a... She studied the Alison White Institute. The Alison White, you know, everybody familiar with the Alison, a very famous individual analytic institute in Manhattan, world-renowned institute. Anyway, the organization became aware that there was a problem with the fact that the training analysts were also the training supervisors at the same institute, and that it was having a negative effect on the trainees. So they passed the rule. That's something that Slater said too. He said, change comes about not by changing the behavior, but rearranging the structure. They changed the rule that training analysts couldn't be also the supervising analysts of their own patients. But the kicker was, the training analysts and the training therapists all participated in the same supervisory group meetings. And in those meetings, she was an observer in these meetings, and she noticed that the therapist, the training therapist, could communicate or would communicate their thoughts and feelings about the supervisees non-verbally. They would frown or scowl or whatever it was to indicate they weren't happy. And when Joan Dolchin presented what she observed to the faculty, because they allowed her to sit in, they denied that it was happening. It wasn't happening. When belief systems in an organization don't jibe with reality, reality gets trumped. The belief systems take precedence over reality. Like that group, I didn't tell you that story. Maybe I did. No, there's another. I was in another group in this organization where a woman came in to the group, and she was agitated about some personal experience, and she was conflicted about presenting it because she had felt some shame about it, and she knew the people in her group, in this group, outside the group, and in therapy with them, whatever it was, and she demurred. She didn't want to talk about it, although she acknowledged that she was upset, and the group reassured her, you can talk about it. We have a rule that there's no outside contact. But there was outside contact. And she still refused, and what happened then was, that was the dangerous part. They said, well, this is evidence of your difficulty with intimacy, that you won't share this with us. So I felt like I was sitting in the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. You know? This is not really happening. This is what's happening. Somebody had a hand? Oh.
Two questions.
Go ahead. Oh, you have to come to the mic.
Okay. Knowing that we have these issues that are inherent in group work, all of the ones that you listed, we know that's helpful, but we know we cannot control the confidentiality of everyone, and yet we're responsible ultimately as the therapist.
Right.
How can we protect ourselves? That's the number one. The second question is, as participants at this institute, we have blurred boundaries in that we're supposed to unveil our issues and work, you know, therapeutically on our own stuff, but yet we're also supposed to be professionals, and many of these people are colleagues, and we're networking. So, again, any suggestions on how to handle both of those?
That's a great question. At one point in my career, I realized I needed to go back into group, but I thought, how can I go into group therapy with people in New York? I knew them all. So I thought, well, maybe I should go to group therapy in Philadelphia, you know, travel to Boston. But then I knew them too. So it's really a conundrum because you have to be political. Like I said a few minutes ago, the irony is that the treatment of group therapists is the most compromised treatment of all, because you really can say everything. Or you can and take the consequences. You have to make a choice. Ultimately, I think it comes down to the person's realizing that you have to keep your own counsel. At the same time, I have to say that when I first started giving these talks about boundaries, nobody showed up. Maybe one person. My girlfriend at the time showed up. She was the only person that came along. But look, I mean, more and more people, the fact that people are here at 7:15 in the morning to talk about this is heartening to me, because it's up to the students as a group. Individually, no one has any power. But as students, as a group of students, and there's an awareness that there is a danger, the fact that the organization allows me to talk in itself, I think, is a wonderful thing. It indicates that, as I said before, the dual nature, the contradictory nature of organizations. There's a need for conformity, that everybody look the other way and say, okay, yeah, we are kind of, and the realization that there's some need for deviance. I'm a deviant. I'm saying it doesn't exist. But what I'm saying also is, to me, the key is continuing to talk about it. Awareness. If it's made aware, that's the first step. Ross? Yes.
So I think you somewhat answered my what was going to be my question about how to deal with it. I have a complicated set of multiple relationships. I was invited to co-lead a training group for senior therapists that had been ongoing for at least 20 years. So I'm a co-leader. In that group, I had started being not a therapist, but a consultant to one of the members. I know many of them mm-hmm. from outside. I have been asked to be a therapist for another member of the training group. Other people are in therapy with.
It's getting complicated as you speak, right?
Kind of a funny thing. I was seeking some medical treatment, and I was about to email the person with whom I was going to get some medical treatment, but I got an email back from him first saying that he's looking forward to seeing everyone in the group. I found out that he's in the training group. I'm now seeing him for medical treatment.
Really?
I am also in a consultation supervision group with my co-leader, who is the supervisor.
Right.
And another group member is a colleague of mine, and we run another training group for residents together. We sequentially co-lead. Mm-hmm. And let's see, is there another one? I've been in institute groups with several of these members, both as a member and a leader.
Okay.
And so what you said about continuing to talk about it, I'm now thinking that if we were to talk about it, that's all we would talk about.
Well, that's right, but that's the only thing to talk about, really.
Okay.
It really is the only thing to talk about. I'm glad you brought that up. To answer the other part of the question, Carol, I think that... you have to be honest with the groups. And I think the most legitimate, it goes back together. One of the most important thing to talk about is this group safe? And why not? And what can you say and what can't you say and why not? I did a workshop yesterday, and it was about my second book about, and some people were here now or there, and if you would, it would be good if you could... add to this as I'm speaking, but one of the things that happened was we did a demonstration group and then a process group. And the process group involved people relating to each other in the moment as it was happening in this environment. In my heart, my mind, that's the solution. There may be compromised treatment groups, but process groups can always exist. Process groups in the sense that you're talking about the here and now, not necessarily about historical data, with the realization that whatever happens may, in fact, get taken out of the room. I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't know how to do it any other way. Because to say confidentiality exists in our groups, I think is delusional. There's like it's an organizational myth. Am I wrong? I mean, come on, what do you think?
I think you're absolutely right.
What's your name?
Chris.
Can you say more, Chris, about that? Right, come to the mic and say it.
I think what I want to say is when I look around the room, there's mostly younger professionals here, and I'm noticing that very few senior group leaders are showing up for such a session.
Well, we have a couple.
We have a few.
Right. But what's the implication of that, do you think, Chris?
Well, didn't Freud say, I don't know means I don't want to know?
That's where I got it from?
That's what I heard. I don't know. Anyway,
or I don't want to tell you. That's the new twist.
Yeah, I don't want to tell you. I want to ask, how did you get the courage to speak out? Like, where did you find that and the fortitude to stick with it?
Well, that's a good question. Since we're all such good friends, how much?
It's 8 o'clock.
When I realized the mess that I had gotten myself into, I went into a tremendous downhill spiral because I protected my leader. I loved him. I mean, I trusted him. I couldn't imagine that he would ever betray me, and yet he did. So, like any significant change in a person's life, you have to go through a period of despair because no real change takes place in a vacuum. And if it were that easy, everybody would do it. So I was driven to the point where I was suicidal. And I realized that if I ever pulled myself out of this, I was going to write about it to protect other people from having to go through what I went through. So where did I get that from? My mother loved me. So I knew somebody loved me. What do you think about that?
That works for me.
Well, it worked for me too. What's your name?
Jeff.
I'm aware that I don't really know what those deep things are. And so if I wanted to read about them or understand what they are, do you have a recommended resource? Or like, how would I learn about those deep, like the depth?
You're supposed to come to the mic. I don't do it. At the risk of appearing to be a hustler, it's in my book. It's all there. Every one of these is described in detail.
I'm aware that part of what propagates this in terms of passing it down to the next generation is that if you're in one of these groups, whether it's AGPA or a training, and you're one of the chosen ones, this is a pretty intoxicating experience, right?
Absolutely.
So, and if you're not one of the chosen ones and you're on the outside, then you have no power.
Right.
So you get to be the chosen few and you continue the legacy of choosing the new the new group.
That's right.
And I think that's part of what just continues to the next generation.
Well, that's very good. What's your name?
Karis Claussen.
Karis. I forgot to mention, one of the conclusions that Joan Dolchin arrived at after her study of the White Institute was part of the need, part of the organization's need for, look, we all have contradictory needs, right? As I said before, there's a need for boundaries and there's a need for blurring boundaries, right? We all need to blur boundaries. I mean, sex is about blurring boundaries in a way, right? I mean, there's pleasure in it. But what she said was there is one of the consequences of the blurred boundaries was an informal way of monitoring the trainees that went through the program to preserve the reputation of the organization and the community. There's always an investment in the status quo. The status quo resistance is one of the basic resistance of all of us individually. We want to keep things the way they are. You know, Newton's law of inertia, an object at rest tends to stay at rest. I will say, though, that groups provide the external force to get people to move. In my groups, all of the people in the groups are anonymous to each other. They have no contact outside group, and yet breaches of confidentiality take place. In one group just the other week, a man was talking about working in a company, private company that was about to go public. One, there's a chapter in my second book. It's called The Cyberstalker, where the advent of the internet increases the risk of violations of confidentiality. This son of a bitch, the other guy, wanted to buy the stock before it went public. So he was able to go on the internet from the bits and pieces of what this other guy was saying. He was able to piece together the name of the company. And he brought this up in a group. I wanted to kill him. And I asked the guy who worked in the company, I said, "You angry?" He said, "No." I said, "No." I said, "If it ever gets found out, you'd be fired or worse, you know." But what I did then was I took it back to me, because the fellow who went online was violating the confidentiality of the group agreement, which was a statement to me. I took it as an act of aggression toward me. And I got focused on that. The irony of this guy was, after he talked about how he's going to buy the stock, he brings up in the group he was just fired from his latest job. This guy constantly gets fired. And he's presenting himself as a victim of this authority figure. So I said to him at some point, I said, "Would you like my opinion?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "If you're as provocative with your bosses at work as you are with me, I can understand why you're always getting fired." He didn't like that. But that was my way of kind of sticking it to him a little bit, you know. But there's a tremendous amount of aggression always in groups too. So the point is, those who are at the top or the chosen ones are going to preserve that. That's why they're not here. They don't want to know about this.
So I think there's a ninth.
What's
that? It's in reference to what you said earlier about how you protected the wrong people, everyone but yourself.
Yes.
And I just want to say out loud to everyone here, pay attention to your own internal experience and respect what you're feeling. It's so important.
But with the proviso that you need an external source of validation, because you're not going to get it from the people who are doing it.
Well, that's right. But the only way you're going to get that is to start with respecting your own experience.
Well, ultimately, right.
Ultimately,
you have
yeah.
to. You have to keep your own counsel. It's the hardest thing to do. But it's essential to maintain your own integrity and to maintain your integrity as a therapist. Because, like I said, I learned a lot from Ormond, what to do, but I also learned a lot not what to do. So, it's ultimately, you know, I guess it's the existential issue that ultimately we're all responsible for the way it turns out, you know. At the same time, the last chapter of my first book has to do with trust and betrayal. You can't be betrayed unless you're willing to trust. If you never trust anybody, you become cynical, what kind of life is that? Ernest Hemingway once said, the only way to know we can trust somebody is to trust somebody and get hurt. We're all going to get hurt. There's no other way around it. Carlos?
I'm very stimulated.
Come forward. I like stimulation. What's that?
I was very stimulated by the presentation, so I started rocking.
Oh.
Yeah, like Ross, almost all of my positions as a Spanish speaker, especially in California, working for UC Davis, was the negotiation of multiple relationships at all times. Walking into meetings with departments where not only the administration, but the faculty or the TAs were my clients. And I was to participate representing the counseling center.
Right.
And my desire as a young professional to fit in or to be accepted by the departments, which was part of my
yes.
responsibility as liaison, increased my own participation in the blurring off.
Yes.
And we talked about it very little because everything is brief.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very grateful for your presentation because
it
speaks about those signals,
right?
Those small signals.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Two things before we conclude. First of all, as group leaders, and as Chris says, the courage comes in acknowledging the breaches of boundaries, whatever else is going on, by the therapist, because the patients, the group patients will protect you. Even under the best circumstances, they will protect you. It's up to the group leader to say, you know, sometimes I'll meet one of my patients in the street. Just, you know, it's a boundary cross. I always ask them their thoughts and feelings about what happened, because I know they're not going to bring it up. Most likely they're not. You have to bring it up. That's where the courage comes in. And if you're not defensive, you allow it, get addressed, leads to the second thing. It has to be addressed. Everything has to be addressed. Saying everything is critical. At the same time, you have to know in what environment you can say everything. So it always comes back to you have to keep your own counsel. And it's a lonely place, but it's the only place. Have a good day. Time for evaluations. If you're doing it the old-fashioned way, I have some left over. If you're doing it online, hope to see you around. If you're interested in talking some more, I'm here. So thank you.